We are creatures of desire. What we most desire is meaning. What makes us suffer most is a lack of meaning.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Marital therapist, author, and communications trainer Andrew G. Marshall invites guests from all walks of life to discuss what makes life meaningful.
Hello, I'm Andrew G. Marshall. Welcome to The Meaningful Life. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Podbeam, and wherever you find your podcasts. When I was younger and a more idealistic therapist, I used to joke that my ambition was for my gravestone to read, "Here lies the man that killed the idea of the soulmate." That's the myth that if you just search hard enough, you could find the one who would truly get you. The one with whom you would have such an understanding that all conflict melts away. The one who makes your pulse quicken not just today, but always. So sex is simple, spontaneous, and connected. And the two of you would just live happily ever after. I had my work cut out because the power of the soulmate myth is reaffirmed in every romantic comedy, every doomed love story, like Romeo and Juliet, who everyone forgets die at the end. And every time one of my clients asks, "Wouldn't it just be easier if we split up and found someone a little bit more compatible?" As if easier is better. Despite being older and more pragmatic, I would still like to kill the soulmate and save your marriage. So on today's edition, I ask what would happen if we dumped the idea of the one, and if we're not going to believe in that anymore, discover what the skills are we might need to make our marriage not just work, which sounds terribly dull, but to thrive, which I think sounds a little bit better. My witness is Dr. Cheryl Fraser, who is both a Buddhist and a sex therapist, or to be more precise, a Buddhist sex therapist, and the author of Buddha's Bedroom, The Mindful Loving Path to Sexual Passion and Lifelong Intimacy. She also has a free online masterclass coming up that might interest you too. So, growing up, Cheryl, did you believe in the one?
Oh yes, it was Sean Cassidy. Sean Cassidy, the actor, the pop singer, and the world's sexiest Hardy Boys. Now, I know you're in Europe, but Hardy Boys was an American TV show here, and I was so deeply, desperately, passionately in love with Sean Cassidy that to this day, my father still teases me because apparently once when I watched it, it's when you had to, you know, you couldn't tape anything. You had to sit in front of the TV at the right time. He says I broke out in hives. I was so excited. And I don't know. I reckon I was around 11, 12 years old, and I really desperately wanted and believed that he would come to Vancouver Island, to the tiny logging town I lived in, sweep me off my feet, take me to Beverly Hills, and I'd live happily ever after. And I wrote him letters. I wrote what today would be called fan fiction, I guess, about me and him. And some, they were quite explicitly sensual and sexual as well. I'm so delighted, Andrew, there was no internet back then. I don't want those to see the light of day. So I say it tongue in cheek, but not really. And when I teach, you've mentioned I've got a live masterclass coming up, which is an introduction to my 12-week program. When I teach that masterclass, I tell this story and I ask people in the chat box to put down who their first big crush was. And I'd love to hear who yours was, if you remember Olo just a few years ago.
I was just thinking of Sean Cassidy, who I think in Europe we might know better as the half-brother or cousin of David Cassidy.
Correct. You're quite correct. Yes, half-brother, maybe full-brother, but yeah, David Cassidy, the Partridge Family.
So I'm going to avoid talking about my... No, okay, I will tell you. I had sort of two people who were on my wall. Oh, actually, three. And these are probably going to be all people you've never heard of.
Perhaps.
The first one was Susie Quattro. Do you know who she was? She was like the first rock and roll chick, and she used to be dressed all in leather. She had a leather jumpsuit. She was a little American girl who actually was on Happy Days at some point.
Ah.
So you might know her, and she did rock music. Then there was Lindsay DePaul, who wore, I mean, when you look at it now, a very large amount of makeup. But she was blonde and sat on the piano and played cute pop songs. And then we used to have a television program called Top of the Pops, where the current artists would appear and they would mime to their records. And obviously there would be people in the charts like David Cassidy who were not necessarily available to pop down to Television Centre. And so they would have a group of girls who would dance to these particular tracks. And they used to do terribly literal interpretation. So if it was "You're So Vain," they would be pointing at the camera and then they would shake their hands to show vain. And they once did a song to, do you remember Gilbert O'Sullivan?
Yeah.
And he had a song called "Get Down," and they actually sung it to a group of dogs. So it was very, it was, and they would wear sexy, but not too sexy for primetime television. And there was one of them called, I think her name was, actually, Sherry, not Cheryl, but Sherry. She was my favourite of the Pan's people. But I never, ever, ever thought I would meet them. And if I'd met Susie Quattro, I would have, in fact, I did many years later meet her and she was as formidable as she sounds. I would have hidden behind the sofa if she'd materialised. And I did actually once interview Lindsay DePaul, who was wow. the sweetest and nicest woman, but she unfortunately had a very unfortunate love life. So she was often serialized in the Sunday papers. She once dated a famous Hollywood movie star who I don't remember just now, but basically he beat her up. So finding the one wasn't the answer for her. And I certainly wasn't the one for her too. But right. I think I didn't really believe in the one. I had a sort of a shield of cynicism because I was frightened of making the wrong choice. I went to the absolute opposite angle. I found the whole thing disempowering and frightening.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, we certainly share the view to kill the soulmate and savior relationship. It's one of the chapter titles, I think, in my book, or a subsection. We're so simpatico on our thinking here. But I tell the Sean Cassidy story first because a lot of people relate to it and that they can rather quickly name, as you've done, early crushes or early romanticized moments in their life. The trouble is when some of us, perhaps not you, but I did, subconsciously carried that template into my more real life romantic and sexual relationship as a teenager and in my 20s, even I would say into my 30s, where I wouldn't have cognitively said, yes, I believe there's only one person. But I acted as though whomever I was in love with, in relationship with, was meant to, in a way, keep me happy ever after. And as I say, we all married the wrong person if they expect us to make us happy all the time. Now, we know this, Andrew, but as you so cleverly said, the romantic comedies, the fiction, I believe after pornography, the greatest, the most commonly utilized entertainment is romantic fiction. It's like millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars. And they are very much soulmate based. There is the one and it is always happily ever after. And they seem to almost always have babies and have a nuclear family and live in idyllic splendor. But it can be, as you know, incredibly damaging in our real relationships. Even people who would swear they think the soulmate myth is foolish, because who does it come from? The soulmate concept comes from, I always get this mixed up, it's either Socrates or Aristotle. And they said that we humans were part of one soul. And they literally said that, right? That as humans, we wander the planet and out there somewhere is the other twinned half of our soul that when we meet, it makes us complete. So we're going back a few years, those darn Greeks putting that idea out there. And then you see it today in any romantic comedy. We could probably look at what's playing in Canada or the UK or Germany right now in the cinema or in the movies and say, yeah, 30% of them are going to end in the illusory happy ever after, which of course brings us to, okay, as couples therapists, how do we work with that? How do we work with that when we've got people in our room who are unhappy or desperately unhappy? And as you've referred to, often the answer is, I think we're just not right for each other anymore, right? And what does that imply? That there's someone who might be.
And what I find, and is the book that I wrote, is I love you, but I'm not in love with you. Mm-hmm. So because soulmates are supposed to get on and you're not supposed to argue, so the things that you don't particularly like or irritate you about your partner, you tend to sort of stifle them because, you know, really, does it matter that much about the fact that they leave their shoes lying around? And so you make it smaller and smaller to the point that it goes away. Now, I've used a stupid example, but it could be standing in for something deeper, like They don't really listen to us before they leap in with their wonderful solution and rather ram it down our throats, which, you know, is a loving thing to do to try and come and rescue us and sort our problems out. But actually not being listened to is really annoying. So we sort of think because we want to be reasonable, we want to be kind, we want to be loving, we're going to push down those feelings of irritation, annoyance, or even blooming anger. And we think that we can shove down just the feelings we want to shove down. So I'll get rid of the anger and the annoyance and the sadness, and I'll just keep the happiness and the connection.
Right.
But we can't choose which feelings we shove down. We end up shoving down all of our feelings, and we become like flatmates. And then till one person says, I love you, but I'm not in love with you. And the thing that I found particularly interesting was lots of these couples who came to see me, once I wrote the book, the only people I ever saw for the next 10 years was, I love you, but I'm not in love with you.
Right.
And they would say to me, everybody thought we were the couple. You know,
that
everybody
perfect
thought,
couple.
You know, we had it sorted, and either one of them or both of them think they did until suddenly they didn't. So it really is actually dangerous for our relationships, the whole idea of the soul partner.
It's incredibly dangerous. And also the implication of that model is that it will be easy. And if we run into dire straits, if we're fighting, if we're miserable, if we've fallen out of sexual connection, if we've fallen out of the in love, however we clinically define that, we sort of have a sense of what in love feels like, then we must be in a lot of trouble. We must be abnormal, and we must be with the wrong person. And the sense of shame, because you and I hear so often what you've shared here is other people think we're the great couple. We're the one they admire. We have so much fun when we're out at dinner parties. We love our vacations, but we're roommates. We haven't made love in years. Let's reassure everybody listening that what you think is normal, what you see in even your close friends as couples, is often not what's going on behind closed doors. And you and I get the privilege to be behind those closed doors with couples who are saying, up to 30 to 40% of long-term couples aren't making love at all. Probably 70 to 85% would say, I'm not really in love with them anymore. And one of the ways I try to address that is with the Passion Triangle model that you're somewhat familiar with, my model of the three aspects of healthy relationship. And I'd love to quickly define those because people, as they're listening, can kind of do a quick rating. How do I think I'm doing in my relationship on each of these three aspects? I call them the three keys to passion, or the three sides of the passion triangle. The idea being that my engineering friend told me when I was developing this particular idea that in engineering, the triangle is the most stable structure. You want to build the heaviest, biggest buildings on a structure of a triangle. So there's the concept. Don't you want to build your romantic relationship on a stable foundation?
Okay, so give us the three, I was going to say corners, but the three points.
The three sides, I suppose, of the triangle.
The three sides of the triangle.
Sure. So I'll name them first, and then I'll briefly define them. They are intimacy, thrill, and sensuality. And I chose these words very deliberately. So let's start with intimacy. Here, I'm not using the word intimacy as a euphemism for sexuality, as in, oh, we were intimate last night. I'm talking about psychological communication, understanding type of intimacy, really the bedrock of a lot of the work we do with couples. Do you feel like your partner's got your back? Are they the person you want to call with the good news or the bad news first? You want to call them first. Can you manage your conflict well? And we could do dozens of podcasts together, and no doubt we each have, on managing conflict, which is different from not having conflict. But can you ideally use a timeout or something similar when things start to move into a flooded, ugly, nasty argument, if that's part of your repertoire? Do you know how to apologize and come back into alignment and communion even after you've had a big upset? Do you know how to listen meaningfully and try to understand your partner when you really do not feel the same about something, even a huge issue, like I want to move to the country and you want to stay in the city, or I want to have another child and you do not. A lot of the work I do in my 12-week online program are working on, the first 4 or 5 weeks are working on the intimacy side, because if I can't get a couple communicating about what they really need and want, and even if they're triggered and upset when they hear their partner's needs, let's go back to the I want to move and you don't, that could be really super stressful. If your work, your family, and you love being in the city, and I'm like, I'm done. I need to move 100 miles away and have a farmhouse. That's very triggering. So intimacy is a pretty big chunk of what a lot of traditional couples therapists would focus a lot of their work on. We've got to be able to understand each other. And I use a technique I call the other side of the clock. And very briefly, if you and your hubby were sitting in front of me in therapy, I would hold up this little clock. I don't have it handy right now. And I would show it to you. And I would say, okay, Andrew, flip a coin. You get to go first. I want you to look at this object in my hand. And it's a small gold clock, by the way. But I say, I want you to pretend you're a Martian. So you don't know what a clock is. And you're going to describe it using any words you want other than the word clock. And you're transmitting that information to your partner up in the spaceship. They need to understand what you're looking at, what you're seeing. Go. And you and the hundreds of people I've done this with would say, well, it's a small object, looks to be around, I don't know, 8 centimeters high, maybe. It's kind of shiny, bit of a gold color. It's got these pointy bits pointing to other pointy bits. And it's got 6 or 8 sides. And I'd say, great, 100%, you're absolutely right. I'd turn to your hubby and say, my dear, what are you looking at? Same test. And I'd flip the clock around. And the back of the clock is black. It's got some dials on and it's got a handle kickstand. And your partner, because no doubt he's very clever, would say, well, it's a black object, maybe 6-sided or something. It's sort of a matte black finish. It's got a few circles on it and this sticky out bit that's maybe a handle or a stand or some side. And I'd say, great, you're absolutely right. Then I turn to the two of you and say, so who's right? And of course, every couple says one of two things. They say either, well, we're both right, or neither of us are right. It's a very simple concept. But when I get reviews at the end of my 12 weeks with couples in the program, invariably they say it was the most important thing they learned, because I then take it into some deep communication techniques around understanding your side of the clock is gold, i.e., you don't want to leave the city. My side of the clock is black. I want to move 100 miles away. We cannot resolve this yet. All we can do is deeply say to each other, Andrew, my love, would you please help me understand your side of the clock? I do not understand why you're so adamant about staying in this city. Help me understand. So there you go.
So what do you do with couples where they actually don't really know what it is they want for themselves, because they're sort of frightened of finishing the sentence, I want, because they're almost inhibited by what the other person's response might be. So they can't even really fantasize about where they would like to live, because they're worried, you know, what if I come up with something the other person doesn't want? And so there's a sort of almost a paralysis there, that actually knowing what they want is actually hard to reach.
Yes, and it's so common, right? We often have a more dominant thinker, a more quiet partner, et cetera, who's maybe less likely to be assertive in that way. What I do with that is I take them into the next exercise. The other side of the clock is the conceptual side, to really get that sense that I may not be seeing it at all the way you are, and I may not at all understand what you're looking at, so to speak. Thinking, feeling. And then I take them into an exercise. You likely use something similar in your own language and in your own work, where each person has 10 minutes to talk completely uninterrupted. And if I'm someone who is the more quiet one, the less verbal one, the one who's more timid to say and state my feelings based on my childhood, based on our interaction in our relationship so far, et cetera, it's pretty challenging to fill 10 minutes. And so that's why I'm very strict in that technique, that the person speaking gets the full 10 minutes, even if they run out of things to say around minute 4. Then they're meant to sit there in graceful silence with their partner witnessing them, and the partner might have to use duct tape on their mouth to silently witness them. And what I find over and over is that the more quiet partner, after say 3-4 minutes, they've said their piece, because they're sitting there in silence, which is, you know, certainly uncomfortable and a little odd, often a minute or two later, they realize another layer and they say, you know, also, when I grew up, I used to go to Granny and Granddad's farm and I was really, really happy there. I think that's partly why I want to move. I feel very overwhelmed and stressed by the noise of the city. But in a normal discourse between those two people, they wouldn't have ever got there, because the more verbose partner, if I say my 3-4 minutes, if I'm the more quiet partner, spoiler alert, I'm not.
What a surprise.
I know. I'm a woman of many mysteries. So in a normal discourse, if partner, Shy, had said 3 or 4 minutes of their stuff, and they said, that's everything, I'm done. Partner, not Shy, would say, okay, thanks for sharing. And then they'd launch into their side, hopefully skillfully and well. But there wouldn't be the space for partner less, you know, processing verbally out loud to go, as I sit here, I'm realizing more. So it's a pretty detailed technique, and you know, I've gone over it rather quickly. But what I find is it's incredibly helpful with that dynamic you've put your finger on. Someone who doesn't actually know, they haven't really sat with the knowing. And particularly if they do it multiple times on one topic, if it's a big topic, like do we sell our condo and buy a farmhouse, it's not going to be resolved quickly. But the more times the partners really try to understand the other person's point of view, that is the only place from which we can look at making an eventual decision or compromise. Most of the time we scatter rush to compromise or decision when I don't fully understand what's going on for you around this. But if I'm the more dominant one, I'll kind of, you know, bully you into my point of view.
So these are the sort of skills that we talk about, which replace the idea of the soul partner. Because, you know, if it's not just going to magically work, you're going to need some tools. And these communication tools, and this is possibly a big one, to be able to speak your truth and to be interested in your partner's truth as well.
Even when it's scary. Like you want a second child and I really, really don't. Like that's the first thing we're going to do is feel agitated and flooded. If you say, honey, I need to talk to you about something big. I want to have another baby. And I'm like, oh, hell's no inside. So this is where the intimacy side of the passion triangle, the language I choose to use for the model, is about all these skills and more. Because frankly, my soulmate would of course want to move to the country as well.
And they would want two children to go with the farmhouse, wouldn't
they? Exactly. Yeah. And we are almost tongue-in-cheek, but it's also really painful, isn't it? When we identify that in ourselves and the longing for partner to be on the same page as us with lots of things, and certainly the bigger things that feel important for our meaningful life.
I mean, to be honest, they sound like the great mother who's going to fulfill all of our needs and wants and is always going to be there. And it's rather difficult to give up the idea that the great mother is going to come and rescue us.
Absolutely. And yet, so far in my life, that hasn't happened. I have to rescue me.
Me too.
Darn it anyway. so there you go. There's a bit about the first side of the passion triangle.
Let's go to the next one, which you say is thrill.
Thrill. And because here... Yeah,
because
if
there is no soulmate, we need to keep the thrill alive, don't we?
Oh, baby, do we ever. There's that wonderful but tragic and I hope incorrect song, you know, the thrill is gone. And that is our felt experience very much of the time. So I want to normalize that for everybody listening, is that if you fall into that category of I love you, but I'm not in love with you anymore, what is lacking is the thrill side of the passion triangle. And we know this, and some people listening are going to roll their eyes. And I say to you, you can roll your little eyes all you want. It doesn't make what we're about to say any less accurate and important, which is, are you romancing your partner? Are you taking them on dates? Are you spontaneous? Do you seduce them sometimes out of the box? Do you make sure they know you appreciate them? Do you leave them love notes around? A lot of the couples in my program have been together for decades, 30, 40, sometimes even 50 years. And I talk a lot, as anyone in this field might, or anyone who's got a heart and a soul and a life, how great it is in the beginning. You know, we all love falling in love, the biochemistry, the sexual tension, and of course, it's novel. Everything's new, exciting. There's uncharted territory to discover in this person's life, in their history, and what they like and don't like. And it is absolutely fantastic. I love falling in love. I think it's the world's greatest roller coaster ride to feel that alive, that on fire, that suffused with what I call thrill, excitement, horniness, joy, the anticipation of did they call me, the planning of our dates. I think of the way my husband, we've been together just over 10 years now, we met in our late 40s, the way we planned our dates to dazzle each other, to surprise each other. Well, everybody who's rolling your eyes right now, how the heck are you doing on that? Would you date you the way you're being with your partner in your long-term relationship right now?
Oh, you're a hard taskmaster.
I am. Gotta do it. Gotta call us to accountability, right? Because so often, as you know, we do sit around and I don't want to belittle this at all because it's very painful, but longing to feel more connected to our sweetheart, longing for more passion and excitement and spontaneity, longing to really feel like we are adored the way a lot of us did in the beginning. So how well does hanging around longing for something lead to behavior change? I would long to, do a triathlon, but it's not going to happen by longing alone. So yeah, I really do call people to task with lots of love. It's tough love, but it is tough, which is literally, and I want everybody answering, if you haven't already answered this for yourself, would you date you the way you are in your relationship right now? Are you, Netflix and laziness and never having a deep conversation? Or are you one of the few who are keeping that skill of romancing your partner alive?
Now, what if people say, well, I wouldn't romance me because, I've put on too much weight, I'm out of condition, I'm old and wrinkly, and who wants me? How do you help them sort of get out of that mindset? Because I think body image is a huge handicap.
It can be. And certainly we work in the real world. In a few weeks, I'm about to celebrate apparently my 60th birthday. I'm still quite sure my mother must have written down that date wrong on the birth certificate. And well, aging's a thing.
I'll be joining you because in a few weeks, I celebrate my 65th birthday.
My good. Look at us. Look at this is what 60 and 65 looks like these days. High five, my friend.
Pretty damn hot, I would say. But
I'd say so, too. Well done. So, yeah, wrinkly bodies, being overweight, physical pain, changes in our body. And even for the people in their 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s listening, sure, there are real world things, but I would be very interested in the mind state that would answer that question the way you've just put it. So if my question is, would you date you based on how you're romancing the partner? And they came with, well, I wouldn't date me because of the way I am. That wasn't actually my question, was it? My question was, the way you're romancing your partner, so thank you for helping me clarify it. Are you lighting them up? Are you planning dates? Do you sweep them away for a romantic weekend once a year, maybe more? Do you say, thank you, love, when they bring you tea or make a lovely meal? Like, are you a good catch? And so when it goes to, well, I'm overweight, I'm old, and I work all the time, then we're into time to do some work on yourself within the relationship. So how can you bring your better self forward? And the whole very important aging and sexuality, body image is a very big topic. And I would approach it in different ways with different couples, but with a lot of dose of realities. My book, Buddha's Bedroom, is based on Buddhist philosophy, as well as couples and sex therapy. And we absolutely cannot change reality. So if the reality is I'm older, I have physical pain, I have erection difficulties, vaginal issues, I'm overweight, I don't feel good in my body. That is the reality we are currently working with. We may choose to take some steps or we may not to change to some degree our body itself, if that's healthful and wise for someone. Other aspects we have very little or almost no control over. Can we love what is? And now we're into a really big realm of denial, really. And I don't mean that unkindly, but we do hang on to, I could certainly fall prey to it as well. We do hang on to, I wish it was like it was, especially in this element of thrill, the second side of the passion triangle. I honestly, Cheryl Fraser, wish I felt the same level of crazy sexual desire and excitement towards my dear man now that I did 10 and a half years ago. It's not as natural or easy. Natural's maybe not a great word here. It's not as easy. I need to work on it. I need to create thrill with my sweetheart. And very high reports of the couples in my 12-week program is they come in often with the I love them, but I'm not in love with them issue. We don't want a divorce. We're not actively looking for an affair, although about 8-10% of the couples in my program are in fair recovery as well. But we rarely make love. It's just, I call it marriage incorporated. We may have covered that in our earlier podcast. I'm not sure. Marriage or relationship incorporated. I say we're running our relationship like a business. The kids get to school on time. The dog gets their toenails clipped when it needs to happen. Everybody's eating some amount of green food and the mortgage is getting paid. We're doing pretty well as parallel lives running the business of us. But where is the romance of us? What here in truncated language I'm calling thrill.
So how do you get from romance to thrill? Because I'm sorry, romance is sort of cuddly on the sofa. Passion is a bit more, I'm going to use the word rumpy pumpy, but it's a bit...
That's two words. Well, I guess it's hyphenated.
But you know what I mean, that that romance can be a little slippers sometimes.
Well, I don't know how you romance in, over there in the UK, my friend, but I'm talking about romance as excitement and intrigue and the way we used to plan dates. But it's an excellent clarification. Luckily, there's a third side to the passion triangle that may answer that, which is sensuality. And here is almost the bridge you've intuitively asked for between dating, romance, fun, excitement. We're going bowling tonight, honey, out of the box, because novelty is exciting. Novelty enhances attraction. There's a rather old study from University of British Columbia by a fellow called Professor Don Dutton, I think, and it was done about 30 years ago. And in this study, briefly, the outcome of the study is when you're in an excited state, you end up finding someone more attractive. And there's a suspension bridge over in Vancouver called the Capilano Suspension Bridge. It's very high. It was at that time, I believe, the longest suspension bridge in the world. So it was kind of exhilarating and scary to walk across it. And they set up an experiment back when we didn't need as much informed consent, I guess. And they had a relatively attractive female ask males, it was hetero-biased, ask males who were about to go across the bridge a couple of boring questions about something like the trees around or something. Oh, I'm from the tree society and can I ask you a few questions? And at the end, she gave the male her phone number and said, if you want any more information about this study, here's the lab, you can reach me there. They also then had this female stooge interview gentlemen after they walked over the suspension bridge right after, same thing, talking about trees or whatever it was. It wasn't trees, but something not very exciting. And here's my number. If you have follow-up questions about the research, be happy to answer them. What they found was the men who'd walked across the suspension bridge were therefore in a higher state of physiological arousal due to excitement, maybe a bit of anxiety, a bit of fear, were statistically more likely to call the attractive female than the men before. So the conclusion Dutton drew, and I think it's a reasonable conclusion based on other experiences, when we're doing something exciting, we find another person more exciting. So bring that into your love affair in the thrill realm, which is instead of just going for a lovely dinner and a theater show, which I think is a fantastic date night, do something different.
So how does the sensuality help us bridge?
Sensuality. Again, I chose that word very deliberately instead of using the word sexuality. When I talk about sensuality, I mean the entire spectrum of sensual pleasure, from melting a bit of chocolate on your tongue slowly to, I want everybody listening to do this right now, and Andrew and I will do it as well. I want you to just close your eyes and for about 10 seconds, gently stroke your inner wrist with the fingers of your other hand and focus on the sensation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've done this with thousands of people, and invariably they say things like, oh, it was quite intense, or it felt really nice, or yeah, that actually felt quite enjoyable. And then I say, well, what was the special sauce? Normally we scratch our arm when we're talking, we don't notice. And the special sauce was simply they were paying attention to the actual sensual experience. But wait, there's a lot of sex and sensuality as well. What I mean is I teach couples everything from holding hands, cuddling. When my partner and I drive anywhere, whoever's driving, the passenger will often have our hand on our partner's knee or the back of their neck. We love to touch. The reason I don't jump right into all the excellent naked stuff, the full erotic spectrum from sweet soul shaking love making to your wildest, you know, black leather clad gorgeousness and everything in between, sharing sensual fantasies, kink, tantra, whatever, is that the majority of couples who come to my programs, let me correct that, it's not the majority of couples, up to usually, and I do polls each and every round, I've taken 8 sets of couples through the Become Passion program so far, and I usually get about 40% of the couples who join my program are in a currently clinically sexless relationship. And there's a lot of definitions for sexless, but the one I use, and there are many other good ones, is they make love 6 or fewer times a year. And of those, about 30% of, say, 100 couples in each program haven't made love in many, many years. So I want to build them up in the sensual realm before we move them to eroticism and what we might call the sexual realm.
Because the great advantage of soul partners is, or when you first get together, the novelty sort of carries you over the embarrassment of being two naked people together.
Yes.
Whereas we really don't see our partner naked that often, you know,
no,
when they're coming in and out of the shower. It's a it's a momentary thing. I think a lot of people are sort of, they're putting up barriers all the time. And in fact, you know, we have to put up barriers to our sensuality and sexuality because, you know, we're going to be overstimulated otherwise because, you know, you see hundreds of attractive people, there are nice things on the billboards. We have to switch ourselves off to get through the day. And switching ourselves back on again, and I think touch is a wonderful way of doing it, that actually stopping your hands from being implements that are picking up a pen and writing a note to something where you actually feel the pen as a, you know, I've got a pen here and it's a sort of, it's got different types of plastic there. And it's quite nice to feel the slightly bumpy part and then the smooth part and actually switch my fingers back on again. But most of the time, I'm just using it to write with. I'm not actually feeling the pen. And it's the same when we're having sex. We're often not actually feeling our partner. We're just using it in a utility kind of way to get off.
Yeah. Yeah. I call it nipple, nipple, crotch, good night. You know, I touch you here, you touch me there. Ideally, we both have an orgasm. It's quite pleasant. I'm not knocking it. But that lack of mindfulness, that lack of presence, that lack of sensuality. And because research is pretty clear that for almost all of us, there's a few minorities, you know, the exception makes the rule, blessings on them. But for almost all of us in a long-term relationship, we have far less spontaneous desire for our partner. That is, I look at you, I'm turned on, I get horny, I say, honey, let's go to bed. There's far less frequent sexuality for the majority of couples in a longer-term relationship. And that can be anything from we've been together 2 or 3 years. It doesn't have to be in the decades. And I want to briefly tell a story that just lights me up. And I've got permission to tell this story. They've done a video telling their story on my testimonials page. But Norm and Cheryl, same name as me, are in their early 70s. And they came to one of my free passion masterclasses. They saw a Facebook ad, didn't know a thing about me. And then they joined my 12-week program 2 years ago now. And they had not been sexual for 30 years. There's a history of multiple affairs. They say this publicly. Again, I have permission to share their story. A lot of verbal abuse, just years of difficulty. And I so applaud them because in their early 70s, they said, we need and deserve more. Let's try one more time. And they were sharing a story just a few weeks ago in my ongoing group, how they said, to your point of not seeing each other naked, that for decades, they each changed separately inside the walk-in closet. They had not seen each other nude in about 25 years. And then this delightful, slightly older couple said, and now we walk around in front of each other naked. We smack each other on the bum and we snuggle naked all the time. And they've successfully, I don't like that word, but they've successfully moved into being sexual again. So it's never too late. So all the discouraged people listening who recognize themselves in that 30 to 40% of little or no sexuality, there are ways to move toward reclaiming and remaking a sensual and sexual life. But I teach a passion triangle on purpose, Andrew. I could probably be really rich if I taught great sex in 6 weeks, just do this, but it wouldn't work. We both know it wouldn't work. And I would just have a no refund guarantee and I guess teach stuff that wouldn't help people. And that's not who I am. So we don't get to the sensuality part till about week 8 of a 12-week journey because I need to build some of those first two pieces in first.
Because I think it's interesting you talking about nakedness as well. I think of all the couples that I've worked with over the years, and I've been doing this for almost 40 years now, Cheryl.
I won't tell anybody.
Who were having the most spontaneous sex. And, you know, when I asked them how much, I mean, I didn't believe how often they were having sex. But what the secret was, is every evening they used to have a bath together. So they used to unwind. They would do the chitty chatty about the day and whatever. And they would do it in the bath together. And it was such a simple transition from there into making love. Mm-hmm. And it's something as small as that can make a huge difference.
Yes. It's a marvelous example. In fact, that's one of the things I start people with when they're ready to be even nude together, because we have to do other things first, like foot rubs or cuddling and spooning with your clothes on. But a bath or a shower, I mean, it's such a beautiful way that's so ignored. Most couples don't ever bathe or shower together. When I had my house built, I'm upstairs in my studio right now in the house that my brother designed and built for me. At the time, I was single by choice, 15-ish years ago. And I had him design a steam shower with two shower heads in it. And he said, well, why two? I said, because although I'm single, I suspect in the future I might choose to be in relationship again. And I want to shower with my sweetheart. And no one likes to be the one who's not under the hot water. So two shower heads. And then eventually I found my person and we steam shower 2-3 times a week together in the evening with some scented essential oils. And whether or not we're moving towards lovemaking, embracing naked, you know, soaping each other's backs, that's part of, and why I use that word sensuality, not just sexuality. So your couple there, we're geniuses. It's such a simple thing, but well done on them.
So in a moment, we're going to be looking at how things can go wrong, and we'll be seeing how we could possibly put them right.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material and other benefits.
So every week we have a look at a letter. If you'd like to write one in, www.andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, you'll find a participate in the program. And you can also sign up for my newsletter there as well. We met 2004 in Switzerland skiing. I was 25 and he was 35. He was married, I was single. We started a long distance relationship as I lived in Germany. He got divorced and we had the most amazing time for the first 2 years. Obviously, we did not live together, and yes, we had lots of sex. I wanted to travel the world, so I did. I went to China for 2 years and we broke up. Fast forward to 2010, 2011, we met again and got back together. The magic was still there, but we were a bit older and maybe mature. I wanted a baby. He, not so much. My husband had the snip about 20 years ago after his first daughter, so reversing that was difficult. So it would have to be IVF for us to conceive. Not the romantic way to start a family, I get it. After our first year, our sex life suffered because we didn't have enough. Until today, I cannot tell you how much is enough for my husband. He won't say, but he always emphasizes that it's not all about the sex. It is the intimacy he misses, which mostly results in sex. He also missed the romances, massages, candlelit dinners, watching the stars. My husband is really the very, very romantic type. He's also very insecure and needy. He needs approval and confirmation. When I don't want to have sex with him, he feels that is a huge rejection. I need the emotional connection, something we have in common or find both fascinating. I'm also rubbish in being vulnerable and expressing how I feel in front of him, as I mostly get annoyed and that does not help. Here is an example. I came home from a trip. My husband had put rose petals on the bed. I was so tired, annoyed that he wanted sex and not in the mood at all, so I brushed the petals away to get into bed. He was very upset as I didn't really acknowledge him or his action at all. We've had 3 attempts at therapy, 2 of them with a sexual focus. We did talk lots about past relationships. I was in one for a bit that was a bit 50 Shades kind of style. The relationship overall was crap, but it was a different sexual experience. My husband said he's not confident enough with me to do anything like that, but he often turns to blame me by saying I'm not giving him the right signals. We have a 9-year-old daughter and both worry what will happen to her if we are separating. We've engaged in the idea of a parent marriage where we as a couple break up but remain in the family home, different rooms, and centre our marriage around our daughter, so nothing or very little will change for her. This will ultimately end up in an open marriage, of which I'm quite scared. Once a new partner comes into the equation, things can change. Can sex lives be changed? Can there be a scenario where both are fulfilled? I don't have to have sex every night, and my husband having his sex needs, or maybe all his needs, met.
It's such a rich letter, isn't it? So many pieces. The way I would approach this is, and it's really quite a beautiful case study for the passion triangle, because as I read through, certain things jump out at me. The emphasis is on sexuality, but there's so much in here missing in the intimacy and the thrill part that can help potentially improve this couple's movement towards sensuality together. On the one hand, she implies her husband would like to have sex a lot more often, but that he says and emphasizes it's not all about the sex. It's the intimacy he misses that mostly can result in sex, romance, massages, candles. So we start to hear the emotional intimacy, the connection, the trust, then the thrill piece, romance, candles. Most of our listeners, I believe, I'm not sure, they'll have to let us know, would be fairly delighted if they got home from a business trip and there were rose petals on the bed. It's quite a lovely gesture. What do you think? No, you're cringing?
Yes, but I mean, I've come back from a business trip and, you know, it's like it's 1 o'clock in the morning and I got up at 4 o'clock to make the plane and I'm tired and I sort of would, I think I can understand how she feels. So I've been up for, you know, almost 20 hours. Yeah. I'm not going to, I mean, I think I could do better than brushing the petals off
the
bed.
That's the key point.
But I would not be up for sex, even right. if there were petals on the bed.
Love that. Had the same thought. But brush them off and go to bed grumpy. Terrible response. Say, oh, love, that's so sweet. Thanks for thinking of that. I'm absolutely pooped. Can you join me for a hot shower? And then let's snuggle and fall asleep. And we can make love tomorrow or the next day. I really look forward to it. But we hear the history here of the hurt feelings for both of them, the pressures for both of them. And that was a great representative sample. And I applaud your listener for sharing it. But then she goes on and says, I need the emotional connection, which is interesting because she was saying he needs it and he wants the intimacy and the romance and that he's needy, which is her characterization and maybe accurate in my view or not. I don't know. I'd need to hear his side of the clock. I need the emotional connection, something we have in common or find both fascinating. I'm also rubbish at being vulnerable, which is a beautiful, vulnerable thing to share. Thank you for sharing it. I mostly get annoyed, etc. So there I hear more work on the intimacy side, the depth communication, the really going more deeply into what's going on for each of you. Therapy, as you know, is not always the game changer we hope it will be. Two of three attempts at therapy with a sexual focus. I wouldn't start with the sexual focus, although that's my primary work. I would start with the hurt and the distance and the two sides. And I'm really fascinated by her second to last paragraph where she talks about maybe being a parenting couple and centering their marriage around their daughter. But she says she believes it will ultimately end up in an open marriage, which I am quite scared of. So, you know, reading between those lines, she doesn't want to walk away from the marriage. It does not sound like at this time, but she's in pain, as no doubt is he, around can our sex drives be changed? The answer is to some degree, yes. Can there be a scenario where both are fulfilled? Yes, but it takes a fair bit of work and understanding and compromise to get to a mutually satisfying sensual life where she doesn't need to have sex every night, nor should she need to. And that isn't a realistic expectation for a lot of partners. While my husband has his sex needs or maybe all his needs met. To me, that's the key. Those last few words, his sex needs or maybe all his needs met. Perhaps some of those needs, as she's explained, are around wanting to feel important, wanting to feel cherished, wanting to be acknowledged for the rose petals, even if I fully agree as a business traveler, sex might not be in the cards, but what a nice gesture. But everyone listening, can you hear the multi-layered complexity of a short one-page letter, the multi-layered complexity of relationship, and why Andrew and I don't generally do a 45-minute meeting with someone and they're through all this, right? For me, it's the 12-week journey at least. But there's a few ideas I have more, but let's hear from the other smart brain on the podcast.
Well, I'm going to go even deeper, I'm afraid. But before I do that, I wonder if at the bottom of all of this is a sort of I'm right and you're wrong, that my version of the marriage, which is going to be more sex, or my version of the marriage, which is going to be less a pressure for sex. I'm going to try and persuade you to take on my side of it.
Right. My side of the clock is correct. Yours is incorrect. Let me try really hard to persuade you to come over to my side.
Yeah. And I think that there's been a huge amount of trying to do that, which is fine. But that could be one of the reasons why the therapy hasn't worked, because each of you have had a goal, which is to try and get the other person to agree with you, and you're never going to get there. Mm-hmm. So when people are stuck, I always say, let's go down a level deeper than this, because each of you are asking the other person for something. I mean, it's very clear what he wants. His self-esteem is to an extent based on how much sex you give him. So in a sense, he's handed you the responsibility for making himself feel good about himself. And if you don't have sex with him, he feels bad about himself and he feels very powerless and very hurt. And, you know, ultimately, how could he actually take on the responsibility for improving his self-esteem? Rather than outsourcing it to you, how can he do that so that he can have his sex, but actually, if you say no, which sometimes is going to happen, it's not going to feel like a huge personal rejection, as if you're rejecting him. What you're actually saying is, no, I don't want to have sex this evening, not, I don't find you a sexual and wonderful person. And I'm wondering what he's actually doing for you. You're talking about vulnerability, because in a sense, he does put all his vulnerability out there on the table. And you're, I'm afraid to say, rather dissing it by calling it neediness. And that probably says to me, you are actually having trouble owning your own neediness. So, you know, why do you have trouble owning your own neediness? What is it that would be underneath this for you? So I think I'm with Cheryl that we don't actually want to get into that central argument, but we want to try and find what's underneath this, what's the level beneath this that we're not actually talking about that we need to understand. So, you know, we really need to understand about his self-esteem. We really need to understand why vulnerability is so terrifying for you. And probably the deeper down you go, you will find a place where the two of you will meet. And this is the hardest part of all. Whatever you decide to do, if you decide to have a parenting marriage or you decide to continue with a sensual marriage, is you have to stay in the crucible of conflict and uncertainty for a long time. We sort of want to solve it, even though you've been in it for a very long time. You've been trying to solve it by become more like me sort of kind of thing. But actually, we're going to stay there and accept those two things, that he has the right to have the sex he wants and you have the right to not have to have sex on demand. Mm-hmm. You know, both of these needs are equally valid. So we need to stay in that crucible of conflict long enough to really understand and then find a third way, which is not your way, not his way, but is a way that is right for your relationship now.
Mm. Yeah, it's beautifully complex, which is why we're never bored in our work. And I am going to stand up for him a little bit, though, because I don't know that he wants sex all the time. There's a lot of mixed messages in this letter, mixed information, where he says it's not all about the sex. He really also adores the intimacy, the romance. He's very romantic. So I'm not sure whether he would necessarily say, I want to have sex every night, if he felt appreciated and adored and his dear, beautiful partner was eventually more able to receive being appreciated and adored instead of being a self-described crap at it. Blessings on them both.
And I wonder what the balance is between being mother and father and being lovers is like. That's another thing that would be worth doing, because your daughter is incredibly important, but she's not with you forever. She's just passing through this relationship. It's the two of you that are going to be hopefully together forever. And maybe the balance needs to switch away from the parenting relationship. I hope those thoughts have been helpful for you. So thank you for joining me on The Meaningful Life today. If people want to find out more about the masterclass, we will have details in the show notes. Is there anything you want to say about it before we go to the final question?
Yes. So what this is, twice a year, I teach a series of a free masterclass. I teach it four times, but you only need to come to one. I teach each one live. And it's where I take a much deeper dive into the passion triangle. And I do some polls. It's all anonymous. You're not on camera or anything like that. And it's an introduction to the 12-week program, which this year, this spring, I'll be kicking off right at the beginning of May 2024. So if you're at all interested in the model, come to the free masterclass, bring your sweetheart. We'll send you a workbook and you can really rate yourself on this. Plus, I will be doing a free Zoom workshop at the end of April as well. People can hear about that. So the link below will bring you perhaps to the waitlist page. We don't open the signups for the actual live classes till a week or so before, but if you go to the waitlist page and get on that, no obligation, you'll be the first to be invited to the free masterclass and the free 3-hour Zoom relationship reboot the end of April.
Well, this is not Cheryl's first go at the pony circus. She's been here before. So instead of asking you what makes your life meaningful, I would like you to talk about an experience that you've had recently that has been meaningful. And you told me about something I would like to hear more about, which sounds incredibly meaningful, which was actually being in Mexico on the Day of the Dead. So I think that would be a meaningful experience. So tell me about that.
Oh, what a delight. And also, thank you for having me back on the podcast. I also had the delight of interviewing you on my podcast, Sex, Love, and Elephants. So your listeners, if they want to hear where I put Andrew on the other side of the microphone, check that out as well.
Oh, no, don't.
Listen. I asked him unexpected questions and he answered them. Day of the Dead. My goodness, you can probably say it with a Spanish accent better than I, so I will allow you to do that. Briefly, my hubby and I chose to be married in Huatulco, Mexico, on the Pacific coast, quite down south. My father lived there half the year. We rented a villa and had 40 of our nearest and dearest, but we went down a week or so early. We'd been there often, and we had the absolute pleasure to be in Oaxaca, a beautiful city in the state of Oaxaca, for the Day of the Dead, which usually falls around November 1st, 2nd. And we were very lucky that we have some Oaxacan friends who live there who took us for the full experience of their street parade. And if you're not familiar, first of all, there's that wonderful Disney movie, and the name's escaping me. We'll have to put it in the show notes. There's a beautiful Disney movie, an animated movie of about 4, 5, 6 years ago that's set around Dia de Muertos.
I've seen it, but can I remember the title of it? But I would thoroughly recommend it too.
It's wonderful. It will give you the idea. But the idea is on Day of the Dead that the barrier, so to speak, between what we call the living world and maybe the world of the spirit world is thinner, and our ancestors can come back, maybe not to visit us in any recognizable form. And so people go to the graveyards and it's celebratory. You go have a glass of mezcal at grandpa's gravesite and you leave food and drink and you celebrate. So we were invited by our friends, which was such a blessing, to go to the parade. And we had the full face paint, the beautiful, if anyone can think of the Mexican sort of skull-like face paint you may have seen. You can Google, you know, Day of the Dead makeup. We did the full makeup. We walked in the parade and we had the really intimate opportunity to go visit our friends' relatives' graves. And it was celebratory. It was gorgeous. And it reminds me, Andrew, that certainly in Canada, and I think most of us British type background people, we're absolutely terrible at death and celebration and mourning and ritual. We have some rituals which are a bit pale, but I was very moved by the openness and the knowledge and the joy of remembering and inviting back those we love and letting them see that we're doing well.
We do at home, because my husband is Mexican, a Day of the Dead altar where you have all the members of the family that have passed away. There's lots of colourful things you put on it. So it's a very joyful thing, and flowers and food. And we found the next morning that the ancestors had eaten some of the food. But I think it was the dog, actually. But
I was going to say, don't you have a dog? But we don't know. The dog's like, hey, Andrew, it wasn't me. I swear this time it wasn't me.
So thank you very much, Cheryl, for being my witness today on The Meaningful Life. The conversation doesn't end here. Love is a choice. That's one of Cheryl's key concepts. We're going to be talking about that. And if you want to hear the bonus material, you can subscribe directly via Apple or Spotify. We're also available on Amazon Music. And if you want to become a supporter of The Meaningful Life, here are the details.
You've been listening to The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can follow Andrew on Twitter, like him on Facebook, and please leave a review wherever you consume your podcasts. Making, editing, and distributing The Meaningful Life comes with substantial costs, and we'd like to ask for your help. Visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material for every program, send in a letter to be discussed by Andrew and his guests, and join a community of other people seeking to make their life meaningful. At the gold level, you get even more benefits. Production of The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall is by Michael Dooney. Social media by Madeleine Healy. Sound engineering and theme tune by Sebastian de la Luz Mendoza. And I'm Susie Colick. Please tell your friends and spread the word. Thank you.